Questions?
Never mind.
Other questions? Okay, so I would have thought that lots of this stuff you had seen before. Certainly you're all aware of the fact that the rest of the world uses Celsius degrees as opposed to Fahrenheit degrees, so we need to be able to convert between them. Maybe a little bit less common is that the real temperature scale should be based on degrees above absolute zero, and so we should be using an absolute system like Kelvin, and most any physics equation is going to want you to use Kelvin in it as opposed to Celsius in it. In particular, the ideal gas equation is going to want you to use absolute temperatures. When we're talking about changes in temperatures, it doesn't matter, because a change in temperature of 10 degrees Celsius is the same thing as a change in temperature of 10 degrees Kelvin. One place where the differences between Fahrenheit and Kelvin and the fact that we're not measuring things from zero can come and bite you is when you're doing unit conversion. So you know that these linear expansion coefficients, for example, have the units of 1 over degrees Celsius. How would you convert that into degrees Fahrenheit? And what matters there is the size of a degree, not where the zero is, but the size of a degree. And if we just care about the size of a degree, I hope you know that Celsius degrees are bigger than Fahrenheit degrees. So 1 degree Celsius is the same as 9/5 of a degree Fahrenheit. So you'd be doing that sort of unit conversion. It's the changes that matter, not the zero points. So obviously it's easy to convert this into degrees Kelvin, right? Because the size of a degree Kelvin is the same as the size of a degree Celsius. And we're good to go.
It's 9/5 degrees Fahrenheit?
Yeah, yep. Well, there.
Okay.
So, So if you're dealing with not absolute temperatures where the zero points matter, but every other case where you see degrees Kelvin or degrees Fahrenheit, it means changes in degrees Kelvin or Fahrenheit. And so what we care about is the size of a degree. And in terms of a size of a degree, a change of 1 degree Celsius is the same as a change of 1 Kelvin, and that's the same as 9/5 degrees Fahrenheit. So those are the conversion factors you use for changes. More questions? I don't know that we're going to be doing unit conversion like that, because I think we'll pretty much always be using Celsius or Kelvin, but I've seen it bite people in the past. The other thing that's useful to remember is this difference between heat and temperature. So when we were talking about heat, we were talking about a stock of energy as opposed to temperature, which is an intrinsic variable that is the same whether you have a little bit or a lot. And we'll learn today that temperature is kind of a measurement of the average kinetic energy of the molecules that make up the object. So if there are lots of molecules, even if they have a little bit of kinetic energy per molecule, they can add up to a lot of heat. Questions? So, I mean, here's the ideal gas equation, but often we're dealing with changes, and this kind of version of it is maybe useful to remember also. Where, kind of like Bernoulli's equation, we can have the situation at one spot and the situation at a different spot, and we can just set up proportions in order to figure out what things are. Questions?
What is the B stand for in the change of volume equation?
The change, this. So that's a beta, and it's a constant that you could look up in CRC. It depends on the material. So it's called the volume expansion coefficient. Values you'd look up.
So beta is the volume expansion
is the linear expansion. Mm-hmm. And the book has an area expansion which didn't make it to the review board. I won't ask you anything about those. I've never found that useful. Questions? Okay, so kind of the main topic for today is to kind of show this relationship between temperature and kinetic energy. And the context for doing this is what's called kinetic molecular theory. And we're trying to get a very simple model for how an ideal gas works. And to start out, let's think about a nice box. And we've got, at least to start out with, one atom that is bouncing around on the inside of this box. Now, pretty much we've always focused on the fact that the gas is pushing out on this surface. But Newton's third law promises us that if the gas is pushing out, the rest of the world is pushing in. So there's a force that is acting on that molecule. And we can calculate that force. It's going to be the pressure times the area. Maybe I should comment in terms of the P's, right? We've got density, we've got pressure, and we have the return today of momentum for a brief period of time. So it'll be a small p, just like that one. It'll only occur briefly.
Isn't P with arrow also another abbreviation for momentum?
So the difference when we put arrows over them are when we're thinking about them as being vectors.
Okay.
And in fact, I'm going to be thinking about just the x component of momentum, so it isn't fair to put the arrow over it.
So this is pressure, right?
This is pressure.
Okay.
So there won't be any densities in the next few minutes, and there will be one momentum, which will be carefully labeled. Anything else that looks like a P is a pressure. Yeah. Should I X it out?
Yeah, just like every time you write it, just put a circle around it.
Okay. It'll only have to do that once, I think. Okay, so we know that the impulse is the force times the time that that force is active, and that has to be equal to the change in momentum. Now, if we have this guy that's bouncing back and forth, we know that its rebound speed is going to be equal and opposite to its incoming speed. So the change in momentum is going to be twice the mass times the velocity in what I'm calling the x direction. The time between these collisions we can calculate because it has to go a distance that is 2d, and it's going at a speed that is vx. So if I put in the time between these collisions and the change in momentum during those collisions, what I've got is that the force, which is the pressure times the area, times the time, which is 2 times the distance divided by the velocity in the x direction, that has to be the change in the momentum, which is 2 times the mass times the velocity in the x direction. Yeah, so the area I'm talking about is this side of the cube, and the length or width, whatever you want to call it, that dimension of this cube is called d. So the molecule has to go there and back, so it's going a distance that's 2d at a speed that is vx. Okay, so we've got some cancellations we can go through. Notice that the area times that distance is the volume. So what I have is the pressure times the volume is equal to mvx squared. So that was with one molecule that was bouncing back and forth. If I have n molecules, we're going to have all of that pressure, all of those forces added up together, and we're going to get that quantity. And that quantity looks kind of familiar, right? MVX squared, that's kind of like the kinetic energy. If you think about it, it's really two times the kinetic energy in the x direction. Right? The whole kinetic energy is one half the mass times the velocity in the x direction, velocity in the y direction, velocity in the z direction, all those things squared.
Okay, so small v is velocity and big v is volume.
Yes. The things that have subscript of x are going to be velocities. Volume doesn't have direction.
What is it? Oh, that's v sub x. That's why.
Okay. So the kinetic energy in the x direction shouldn't be any different than the kinetic energy in the y direction or the z direction. They should all be, on average, equal. So the kinetic energy in the x direction should be one-third the kinetic energy, period. So now let's kind of revamp what we've got. We've got the pressure times the volume is the number of atoms times 3/2 the kinetic energy of a atom. Oops, 2/3. Yes? So the kinetic energy is x, y, and z, and presumably x, y, and z are just like x, right? In terms of the speed, right? The atom isn't going any faster in the x direction than it's going in the y or the z directions. That is to say, its orientation is going to be random. So the kinetic energy in just the x direction is going to be 1/3 of the total on average. So this was the kinetic energy of a atom. What ideal gas law tells us is that the pressure times the volume is the number of moles times R times the temperature. And we can make this look more like what's on that side by remembering that the number of moles is the number of atoms divided by Avogadro's number. So, I don't know, maybe plug and chug. So we have n divided by Avogadro's number times RT is equal to the number of molecules times 2/3 the kinetic energy of a molecule. So I don't know, here's the ratio of two constants. One of them's named for a dead physicist. The gas constant isn't named for a dead physicist, so this is an opportunity for naming. We can sell it. Yeah, Avogadro's number. So the gas constant divided by Avogadro's number, we're going to sell to Boltzmann. So this is Boltzmann's constant, and it's usually denoted by K or K sub B. So you can see the n's go away, so we have KB times 3/2 is equal to the kinetic energy of a molecule, times temperature. A molecule that's bouncing around inside the box. So that's the relationship we were looking for. There's a linear relationship between the temperature of the gas and the kinetic energy of the atoms that are bouncing around on the inside.
This says B-I-H-Z, pointing to the Avogadro.
Boltzmann, B-O. The famous dead physicist Boltzmann. Yes, so that's a value like Newton's gravitational constant that is look-upable.
Is the temperature in Kelvin or Celsius?
A little bit louder?
Is the temperature in Kelvin?
Temperature is always in Kelvin. More questions?
Why is it 2/3?
So the first two came from the fact that we had mv squared as opposed to 1/2 mv squared. And the 1/3 came from the fact that what we had here was just the x direction, and presumably the y and the z are the same. So that led to this 2/3, and then when it came upstairs, it got 3/2. More questions? Okay, so temperature is a measurement of the kind of average kinetic energy of the particles that make up the system. And we were thinking about a gas, and the only thing a gas can do is have kinetic energy, but if we're thinking about solids, we're thinking about these kind of little springs that are holding together a solids, then we have the possibility of potential energy in addition to kinetic energy. So we could add all of those things up and we could talk about the internal energy of the system. And it's usually denoted by U, and this would be a combination of the potential energy and the kinetic energy that the object has, right? So for a gas, it doesn't have any spring, so it doesn't have any potential energy. So the internal energy is just going to be kinetic energy. So it turns out that if we look at the atoms that make up the air in this room, for example, they don't have all the same kinetic energy. There's a range of kinetic energies. There's a distribution of kinetic energies. So if we were to make a plot of the speed of the atoms versus the number of atoms that have that speed, there's kind of a bell-shaped curve. And you know, with any curve, we can talk about mean, median, and mode sorts of possibilities. It turns out that the velocity we could calculate from this kinetic energy, right? We could set that kinetic energy equal to 1/2 mv squared. What this is then is it's the average of something that's squared. If we take 2 times the kinetic energy and divide it by mass, take the square root, to get that speed, this would be the root of the average, which is mean, squared. And root mean squared is usually abbreviated RMS. So it turns out that this speed that you would calculate is a little bit off to the side on this curve. And the average speed would be a little bit slower, and the most common speed would be slower still. But for all intents and purposes, those are all within, I think, about 10% of each other. This would be a typical speed of the atoms that are in a particular gas. So, I don't know, famous dead physicists. This one's named for Maxwell and Boltzmann, and sometimes called the Maxwell-Boltzmann speed distribution.
So we're not going to need to know that graph, will we, just that equation?
I don't know what knowing the graph means. You should know everything.
I can understand that the speed is, the most average speed will be the highest point. But I mean, it just kind of seems like extra information we don't necessarily need, just the equation seems useful.
I suspect that's true. But, I mean, you should have, I think, some idea of this basic fact, that there's a bell-shaped curve, they're not moving at all the exact same speed, and that if push comes to shove, the average speed is a little bit different from the RMS speed, is a little bit different from the most common speed, but I'm never going to ask you, you know, to calculate any of those two quantities. The only equation that is memorable is this equation. I don't know. How about something like that? The average speed of air molecules at room temperature is about what? Nah, I'm not going to ask you to. Was that an A? So so you notice down here it asks for the average velocity, and the average velocity certainly is zero. There's as much moving to the left and to the right. But you remember that speed was the magnitude; it didn't depend on the direction. So they're all moving. So zero is not the answer. Well, let's calculate it, right? So we have twice the kinetic energy, and the kinetic energy is given by that. So this is the square root of 3 times the Boltzmann constant times temperature divided by the mass of an atom. How much do the atoms, I should say molecules, in this room weigh? Say again?
One atmosphere.
I like a lot of that, but not enough of it to count. So the atmospheric pressure is the weight of the air, but it's all the air up to the vacuum of space. And I'm asking, how much does one molecule weigh?
Not very much at all,
but it weighs something. How could we calculate it? Yeah, if you know the mass of a mole and you know how many atoms are bouncing around in a mole, you should be able to calculate it. So what's the molar mass of the air in this room?
How many moles?
Well, we're talking about the gram molecular weight. So what's the gram molecular weight of the molecules in this room?
32 grams per mole.
32 is not a bad number. That comes from O2, 16 times 2. It's mostly nitrogen, and that's what times 2? 14 times 2. 28. The next most common one is argon, which is, I think, 40. So, I don't know. 32, 28, let's call it 30 as a good average. So there are 30 grams per mole. Well, you had 32. That's close enough. Right? 32, 28, halfway between. Any of those are good. So, how many atoms per mole? 6 times 10 to the 23rd. So, a atom weighs 30 grams divided by 6 times 10 to the 23rd. I want to convert that to kilograms, of course, so it's 0.02030 divided by 6 times 10 to the 23rd. What's the Boltzmann constant? Yeah. But that kind of leads to a hint. If this thing is the gas constant divided by Avogadro's number, and this thing was the molar mass in kilograms divided by Avogadro's number, then instead of looking up the Boltzmann constant, which I could do, it's perfectly good, but you knew what the gas constant was, so I could calculate this just as well as being 3 times the gas constant times the temperature, say 300 Kelvin, divided by the molar mass. So we got 3, we've got 8.31, and we got 300, 0.03 divided by square root. And boy, with that choice, the answer is 499.3 meters per second, right? Pretty close to D.
Wait, they're really moving that. What's your answer?
Say again? Well, not only are they going that fast, there are a lot of them that are going faster, right? So all the time, bullets are hitting your body at, you know, faster than a speeding bullet, supersonic speeds. Luckily, they're pretty light bullets, so they don't do a lot of damage. They just bounce off.
But they do damage.
I don't know if they do damage or not.
Where did that equation come from, by the way, the square root of 3 times that constant? I see the 3 halves.
So this was kinetic energy, right? Twice the kinetic energy to get rid of the 2 and then take the square root to get the velocity. And we have that the kinetic energy is equal to 3 halves kBT.
Is that how like gas escapes like so easily with the spacecraft, like gets a rupture inside?
So let me start with a different story that I think will be similar. So most of the universe is hydrogen and helium, right? You should know that. 98% of the universe is hydrogen and helium. 98% of the atoms. Actually, most of the stuff of the universe is not atoms, but most of the atoms are hydrogen or helium. Why aren't there lots of hydrogen and helium on Earth? Right? Jupiter, Sun, those things are mostly hydrogen or helium. Why is the Earth mostly silicon, oxygen, stuff like that?
Fusion.
Well, if we put in a very small mass, we're going to get a very big velocity. And you know that generally speaking, what goes up comes down, but there's an escape velocity. If you throw something up fast enough, it's not coming back. So for hydrogen and helium, these atoms at the tail are moving 25,000 miles an hour, and they're gone. And you wait 4,000 years, or excuse me, you wait, I guess if I were fundamentalist, it would be 4,000 years. But if you wait 4 billion years, a more realistic period for the Earth, those molecules would be gone. So we don't have hydrogen and helium because it escaped. It escaped because it has a low mass. It hangs on to Jupiter because Jupiter has a higher escape velocity.
I just can't read when it says 3 and then it says R and then something else and then T.
This one here? Yeah. So let's start with this one here. So that was the square root of 2 times the kinetic energy divided by mass. And that should make perfectly good sense, right? The 2 gets rid of the 1/2, the mass, we're good to go. This is a formula for the kinetic energy, 3/2. So we have 3 kb times t divided by mass. And what we were going to put in for the mass was the molar weight divided by Avogadro's number. And we could look up Boltzmann's constant if we wanted to, but according to this, Boltzmann's constant is just the gas constant divided by N naught. So if I rewrite what I've got 3 times R over N naught times T divided by the molar mass in kilograms. And those guys go away. So what I've got is the square root of 3RT divided by the 0.03. There's nothing wrong with just looking up Boltzmann's constant. I think it's 1.38 times 10 to the minus 23rd. But you trust me on that. But the gas constant is something that's a little bit more fundamental. Questions? Okay, so when we were talking about heat last time, so we said that roughly speaking, for an ideal gas, the kinetic energy is proportional to the kinetic energy. If we're thinking about a solid, then we should add in the potential energy too, maybe. And we should think about what the internal energy is as a function of temperature. So if we were to make a graph of the internal energy, usually denoted by U, versus temperature, generally speaking, if you increase the temperature, you're going to get more potential energy. But it's not necessarily going to be a linear relationship the way it was with the ideal gas. So in fact, if we were to look at the relationship in greater detail, yeah, it turns out that it maybe kind of looks like that for a typical circumstance.
What does U stand for again?
The U?
Yes.
So that's the internal energy, the total potential and kinetic energy of the system. So now I'm thinking about any material. And I'm probably actually going to mostly apply this to solids, so even more so to solids. So if the chemists had been doing their work, you also know about enthalpy. Have the chemists been doing their work? Some yeses and some noes. No. The other class was yes. So usually the enthalpy. All the biologists know about G. Gibbs free energy? Name for the famous dead physicist Gibbs, one of the first famous American physicists, circa 1900. And entropy. And in the last class, somebody could tell me what G was. 1.8 meters per second. No.
Delta H.
Yeah. T delta S. So all these, so these three things at least have the units of energy, and they are pretty closely related. And if you're more familiar with enthalpy, you can think about the internal energy as being the enthalpy of the system. That would be fine. We'll talk maybe more about the moderate difference between enthalpy and internal energy. But in any case, roughly speaking, all of these things are the potential energy plus the kinetic energy of the system. Some of that potential energy might be in chemical bonds. Some of it might be equivalently in springs. A lot of it is going to be in the form of kinetic energy. And kind of no surprise, if we increase the temperature, there's going to be more kinetic energy for sure. There's also typically going to be more potential energy because these springs are going to be stretched. I don't think there's any equation that I circled. So this is internal energy. That's the symbol of U. And that's just exactly the potential energy plus the kinetic energy. Enthalpy is mostly the same, but it's slightly different. And at least right now, I'm not going to be stressing the difference. So if you should, in your chemistry classes, have been talking about enthalpy. And you can think about that as being internal energy. They're very, very closely related. And Gibbs free energy is pretty closely related to enthalpy, but if we want to get the details right, it also involves a correction due to entropy. So a lot of these terms we haven't defined, and we'll get around to it eventually, but I'm thinking that at least the biologists all know about Gibbs, maybe not the chemists. So if you go outside Liz Wardock's office, you'll see a stash of candy that is labeled Delta G, right? If you ever want candy. Guess not. So if we change the temperature, say we go from this temperature to that temperature, there's going to be a corresponding change in the internal energy. And I hope it's pretty clear that the change in the internal energy is going to be the slope times the change in temperature, right? That is to say that the slope is the rise over run. Now, remember that internal energy is an extensive quantity. More mass is going to be more internal energy, whereas temperature is going to be an intrinsic quantity. So we might as well factor out the fact that more mass is going to give us more change in internal energy. And this slope we can name for nobody in particular. We can call this a specific heat. The word specific usually refers to a per quantity. So this is, in some sense, the enthalpy per gram. But we could also do this per mole. We could conceivably do this per cubic centimeter if we wanted to. All of these things are pretty closely related. What's the basic idea is that if we increase the temperature, we're going to get a corresponding change in the internal energy, or if you prefer, in the enthalpy. We're going to refer to changes in internal energy as heat, denoted by Q. Okay, so before we were talking about the heat of Lake Superior, talking about the stock, and now we're going to use the word heat to describe changes in internal energy. Okay, so the usual letter for specific heat is C. And if you take a look at what the units have to be, energy is going to be measured in joules, and we need to divide this by kilograms and degrees Celsius or degrees Kelvin. Take your favorite amount. Now, old-fashioned people talk about heats in calories. And calorie is just, before people realized that energy was one sort of thing, they thought of heat energy as being different from mechanical energy. But a calorie is exactly 1.84 joules. So if you want to use calories, you can. I think our book is using joules every place for energies. So the reason the calorie was invented is kind of the same reason that a density of 1 was created for water, right? 1 gram per cubic centimeter. Water has a specific heat that's about 1 calorie per gram degree. Okay, so if I start with, I need a big board for this. So if I start with my graph of temperature versus internal energy, and say we start with ice, turns out that this curve looks like this. So ice has a moderately constant slope, a specific heat. But when we reach a particular temperature, 273, we can add more and more energy, but the temperature doesn't change at all. What happens is we have a big increase in internal energy, but no change in temperature as the ice breaks all of those hydrogen bonds and it becomes liquid water. So this energy, the energy it takes to melt a gram of water, that's called the latent heat. Sometimes called the heat of fusion. And the word fusion here is just talking about melting.
So energy required to melt ice?
So it's the energy required to melt a gram of ice. 1 gram. Typically, it could be done per cubic centimeter or per mole, but very commonly these things are done per mass. 273. So it's 0 degrees Celsius, which in terms of absolute temperature is 273. Okay, so at this point we've got liquid water, and again we have a more or less constant slope relationship between internal energy and temperature. But when we reach 373, the boiling point of water, once again a huge amount of energy can be added without changing the temperature as we go from liquid to gas. And once we've reached the gas phase, once again, there's a more or less linear relationship between internal energy and temperature with a yet another specific heat, yet another different slope. Okay, so this energy here, the energy to vaporize something, would be called the latent heat of vaporization. Okay. So the amount of heat it takes to boil or melt something is typically the mass times one of these latent heats. The amount of heat it takes to change the temperature of something is the mass times the specific heat times the change in temperature. So here we have a phase change, and here we don't have a phase change. We're keeping with one object.
So latent heat has the same variable as length?
You mean the same letter? Yes. Yeah. We're kind of done with lengths. There are only 26 letters.
Can't they start using cursive letters or something?
Question.
When would you use those equations?
So if we have the same phase, it might be ice, it might be water, it might be gas, then we can calculate the change in internal energy using the corresponding specific heat. If we have a change in phase, then there's no change in temperature during that process, but there's energy that it takes, and the energy that it takes is the corresponding latent heat. So specific heats and latent heats are things that you would look up in tables, the way you would look up beta and alpha and Young's modulus.
You
bottom equation, does that equal Q as well?
Yes. So they're different Qs, right? But they're all heats. They're all changes in internal energy. So I could just as well write the change in internal energy. Or if I wanted to be more specific, I could say the change in the enthalpy. And also, here's a table of specific heats. You can memorize it. So here we have specific heats of the elements in terms of joules per gram K. You know, they're wildly different, right? Here's 14. Here's something that is basically a hundredth as big. One thing that's kind of interesting is if you look at this column, which is the specific heat in terms of moles per Kelvin, there's much more consistency. There's still exceptions, right? So here's carbon, here's boron, here's beryllium. Those are unusually low, but pretty much everything else is kind of 25-ish. So the famous dead physicists Dulong and Petit, who have their names carved at the base of the Eiffel Tower along with 72 other famous French scientists, their name for this observation that the specific heat of solids per mole is pretty much a constant. If we think about the exceptions, there's kind of a common feature, if you think about it, between carbon and boron and beryllium, right? They're all early atomic elements. They're low mass atoms as opposed to the rest of them. Say again? Okay, questions? Well, so let's take a look at some of the homework problems. They're maybe easier than where we are. So we've got some ideal gas law equations, and we've got some questions that deal with the speed of molecules. Let's start with the ideal gas law questions. So here we have a tire. It's inflated with gas that was at 1 degree Celsius, and at, or excuse me, 10 degrees Celsius and at atmospheric pressure. During the process, the air was compressed, and it turns out that typically if you compress air, you heat the air. We'll talk about that process in the future. And the question is, what's the pressure of the in the tires? So this is the same quantity of air. So we have kind of a before and an after situation, so things are nicely set up for that version of it. And we're asked for what the pressure is. So the pressure is the original pressure times the ratio of the volumes times the ratio of the temperatures. And if you're not sure about where the twos and the ones go, you can rearrange this equation or you can just think about it. Higher temperature should increase the pressure. Higher volume, expanding it, should decrease the pressure. And if you just think about it, you can think about which way these terms have to go. Okay, so the original pressure was atmospheric pressure. They don't tell us what these volumes are, but they tell us that the final volume was 28% of the initial volume, excuse me. And they tell us that the final temperature was 273 plus 40, whereas the initial temperature was 273 plus 10. So of course, the volumes cancel out. We can add that up to get 283. We can add that up to get 313. So what we have is 1.01 in our exponent 5. And we're supposed to divide by 0.28 and multiply by 313 and divide by 283. And what I get is pretty much 4 times 10 to the fifth, 4 atmospheres. After the car is driven at high speed, the tire's temperature becomes a little bit less than the boiling point of water, and things that are hot expand, not so much for rubber, but they say that the rubber expands by 2%. What is the pressure now? So call that pressure 3. That's equal to the pressure we just calculated, the ratio of the volumes. And we're told that this volume is 2% more than what it was. And the ratio of the temperatures, so it was at 40 degrees Celsius, and now it's at whatever 273 plus 85 is. So once again, these volumes cancel out. We have our pressure, so which is sitting in my calculator. So I've got 273 plus 85, which is 358. So 358 divided by 313 and then I'll divide that all by 102. Oops. And I get 4.47 times 10 to the 5th pascals.
How did the volumes cancel out?
So they told us, they've never told us a volume. They've always given us ratios. In the first part, they said that the compressed volume was 28% of the initial volume. So that volume, 0.28 times V1, the V1s cancel top and bottom. In the second problem, they said that this volume was 2% more than it was before, so 1.02. Questions? Okay, so we've got 8 liters, 20 degrees Celsius, 9 atmospheres, determine the number of moles of gas. So PV equals NRT. So PV divided by RT is going to give us N. So the pressure is 9 atmospheres. Remember that there are 1,000 liters in a cubic meter. So 8 liters is 0.008 cubic meters. R is 8.31, and the temperature is 20 degrees more than 273 or 293. So we've got 9.09 NR exponent 5 and 0.008 times that, 8.31 dividing that, and 293. And what we get is pretty much 3 moles. Is that what I got before? Yep. Yeah, 2.99 moles. How many molecules are in there? Well, we know Avogadro's number, right? So all we have to do is multiply 6 times 10 to the 23rd times 3. To get the corresponding number of molecules. What's the average kinetic energy of a molecule of oxygen at 300 K? Well, here's the formula, right? 3 halves the Boltzmann constant times the temperature. Oxygen is irrelevant, right? So the Boltzmann constant, if you look it up, 1.38 times 10 to the minus 23rd. The temperature is 300. And of course, we're going to get a very small number for the kinetic energy of a single molecule. It's going pretty fast, but it doesn't weigh a whole lot. And I get 6.21 times 10 to the minus 21 joules. What's the mass of a helium atom? Well, we know from helium's spot on the periodic table that it has a gram molecular weight of 4. So 0.004 kilograms is 6 times 10 to the 23rd atoms. So if I divide 6 times 10 to the 23rd into the 4 kilograms, I should get the mass of a helium atom. Okay, so here we've got 7 liters, which is 007 cubic meters, 3.5 moles of ideal gas. They tell us the pressure. Find the temperature.
Wait, so where did you do 41 at?
Where did I do 41? Yeah, I never bothered to do the division.
Well, it's just that up there.
Yep, so we know the mass and we know the number, so all I have to do is divide the number into the mass. Okay, so find the temperature. So we've got PV over NR is T. So they tell us the pressure, 1.6 times 10 to the 6, so basically 16 atmospheres. Remember that 1,000 liters are in a cubic meter, so 0.007 cubic meters. Divide that by the 3.5 moles and the 8.31 gas constant. And I get 385 Kelvin, of course, for the corresponding temperature. Find the average kinetic energy. Well, we've done that, right? Just have to plug that number in there. What do I need to get the speed? Well, if I know the kinetic energy of something, if I want to get the speed, I need to know the mass. So you tell me the mass of an atom and the kinetic energy, and I can tell you this corresponding speed. Questions?
In this case, that KB, that 1.38 times 10 to the 23rd, is that just the accepted value for ideal gas, or where did that come from?
So I could say yes or I could say no. How's that for an answer? So I have said that the Boltzmann constant is the gas constant divided by Avogadro's number.
The gas constant, yeah. Which?
8.31.
Okay.
But that kind of misses the point. It really turns out that the gas constant is Avogadro's number times Boltzmann's constant. That is to say, Boltzmann's constant is the fundamental thing. The gas constant deals with a non-existent quantity, an ideal gas, right? There aren't ideal gases. There are only approximately ideal gases.
I know you just mentioned this, but how do we get from 7 liters to 0.007?
Yeah.
Liters cubed again, and I just said it,
yeah.
I didn't catch it.
So the answer is a factor of 1,000. So the question is, how do I get that factor of 1,000? So a liter may seem big, but it's small change compared to a cubic meter. And one way of getting there is the following. So 1 liter, I hope you know, is 1,000 cubic centimeters, 1,000 milliliters. So, and obviously there are 100 centimeters in a meter, and I need to cube that.
Why do you need to cube
that? Because the centimeters are cubed. And I need to get cubic meters. So this is 1 liter divided by 1,000. Of course, the centimeters cubes are going to go away. And 100 cubed is 1,000,000. So 1,000 liters are a cubic meter.
Yes, no, or would we have to write that down on an exam? Or?
So I mean, it might be something to smart to put on your cheat sheet. I don't.
I mean, if you were to give us something in 7 liters, and then in our equation we just put it straight to 0.0007 cubic, that would
be fine. Yep. Same thing if you convert grams to kilograms in your head, right? Those sorts of centimeters to meters. There's no explanation required.
Okay.
More questions. So this was the ideal gas law, and ideal gases don't exist. What's closer to the truth? So in this class, we've talked about a lot of famous dead physicists, right, starting kind of with Newton. And we worked our way up to physicists who are engraved at the base of the Eiffel Tower, but we haven't gotten to any Nobel Prize winners, right? And that's because Nobel Prizes started in 1900. So we'll do lots of Nobel Prize winners in 106, but we can get to one Nobel Prize winning physicist, van der Waals. Right, so I think 1906 or something, Nobel Prize in Physics by van der Waals. So what van der Waals claimed is that the atoms actually can't bounce around every place inside that box, that some of the volume is excluded because of the atoms being there. So the volume we should use should be less according to the number of atoms that are in the box. And the pressure that we're going to measure, if we think about the situation, here are these atoms. Before that atom gets to bounce off this wall, it's going to be pulled away from its brothers. And there's a force that keeps them together, which is called van der Waals forces. So the velocity is going to be a little bit less in that bounce, which is to say the pressure is going to be a little bit less. So we can make these corrections and get, I'm not going to bother to write down the equation, to get an updated version of the ideal gas law that's actually more appropriate to the gases, even gases like oxygen in compressed air cylinders. But I guess one of the things I want to say is that even though he won the Nobel Prize, it's not exactly correct in lots of regards. So first of all, the idea that an atom has a surface or a shape or a size is basically wrong. Right? So if you took a mathematical line, you could shove it right through this table and never hit anything, right? Atoms are mostly empty space. They don't have literal sizes. So another way of kind of getting at that is to think about, you know, kind of the grade school picture of an atom, right, where we have electrons that are circling around a nucleus. If you had a little box and you wanted to catch electrons, where would be the most probable spot where you could capture electrons? On top of the nucleus. The most likely spot for an electron to be in a hydrogen atom is sitting on top of a nucleus. Not in the reverse. Nope. Most likely spot. 106, right? Schrodinger's equation. So the nucleus is just a bag of quarks. There's nothing there. There's nothing that keeps the electrons from crashing through the nucleus on a regular basis, and in fact, that's the most common spot for the electron to be, the highest probability density.
But aren't they being like pulled away from the nucleus?
Well, actually attracted to the nucleus,
oh,
right?
That's
so
right. Yeah.
It's kind of no surprise that they're there. So atoms are mostly nothing. They don't have surfaces, they don't have volumes. Anyone who tells you differently doesn't know their quantum mechanics. Say again?
Throughout its orbital.
No. Nope. So probably what you mean about an orbital is the stuff out here. And that's less. There's less probability. You take a little box and try and catch an electron, you'll be a whole lot less effective out here than you will if you put it right on top of the nucleus.
Can you explain that one more time? Some more quarks?
Well, so the nucleus is just a bag of quarks.
Right. Okay.
So there's nothing really there. Electrons happily go through the nucleus all the time. Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
So, what are quarks? Oh, I mean, I get there's subatomic particles that make up protons and
neutrons. Then you know everything. Two up quarks and a down quark to a proton.
They're just forces, they're not mass at all, so mass doesn't exist.
Boy, those are tricky questions.
Well, what means?
So, mass is an illusion caused by the Higgs boson, so.
Cool.
Yeah, totally.
That's not throwing fig. So it's not Higgs. It's not clear that Peter Higgs will get his Nobel Prize, but he might. So I've kind of blown off my nice demos. So the only way to blow up a balloon is, of course, is to blow it up, right? You have to put air in. I'm pulling. And there's no connection to that balloon, right? So.
So
I'm just decreasing the pressure inside this container, and the balloon is expanding. So here's the one that my wife wouldn't want me to do. So, you see that little silvery liquid? Mercury. So we kind of ignore air and gases in general. In fact, historically, it took a while before people kind of believed that there was something out there because the density is so low. So if we were to go to Venus, where the density of air is about 10 times the density of the air on Earth, it's about a tenth the density of water, we would very much notice the density of the air. So here we have a gas of mercury, and you can see that it's pushing around those little particles of glass that have, you know, quite a noticeable weight just fine, right? So if you have massive atoms, you're going to have quite noticeable effect due to the gas that's causing them. Is that win points or not?
Yeah, that's good.
This one I don't know if is so great a demo. So this is just a PV equals NRT. So one of the things that's interesting here is the scale, which you can all see, I'm sure. So this is a scale that, like most scales, reads zero when it's open to atmospheric pressure. It's a gauge. But it actually goes negative, so it can read suctions. It can read pressures that are below atmospheric pressure as a negative number. So gauge pressure can be negative. And what we have is the ability to compress the cylinder. And as I do that, the pressure should go up, 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 up. And I can feel extra force in order to twist this as I get down. Is it doing things? Yeah, it's moving. I wonder how hard I can push it. So that's the other kind of funny thing. The units on this are not PSIs. They're not inches of mercury. They are newtons per square centimeter. I've seen worse, right? Kilograms per square centimeter. Yuck. Okay, well, I guess that's it. I'm sure you're disappointed that we have to quit 5 minutes early. Aww. So the next quiz, I think, is Wednesday. And what we'll do Monday is more of this Q equals MC delta T sort of thing. And then the quiz on Wednesday will be a Q equals MC delta T sort of quiz.